Welcome to this week's edition of Liberation Radio, podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Each week, we bring you interviews and analysis on the struggles affecting poor and working people throughout the U.S. and the world, building the movement for socialism in the United States. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. This week, we hear about the struggle in Albuquerque, New Mexico, being organized and led by the Red Nation in attempts to abolish Columbus Day and also to win some rights for Native people and protection of Native lands. We also hear about the struggle in Washington, D.C. against Mayor Bowser and her new plan to expand police powers and increase penalties for several crimes. But first, we speak with Gloria LaRiva, a leading member of the PSL and the PSL's 2016 presidential candidate. We discuss the massive demonstrations and social movement that's happening right now in Guatemala and that has forced the president, Otto Perez Molina, to resign and the elections that proceeded on September 6th. We have on Gloria LaRiva, leading member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation and the PSL's 2016 presidential candidate. Gloria recently wrote an article for Liberation News about the massive demonstrations and growing social movement in Guatemala that's been developing over the past couple of months. This week's elections took place and we wanted to get a follow-up on what's going on. Gloria, how are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much.
Can you give our listeners some context of what's been taking place in Guatemala this year?
Yes. Well, first, there was a convergence of two events that took place after months of massive protests, including demonstrations that were at least 200,000 people. Otto Perez Molina, the president of Guatemala, was forced to resign on September 2nd due to charges and exposure of his involvement in bribery and huge fraud involving customs income at the border. But he's not being tried for a greater crime that he's involved in, and that was massive genocidal extermination of over 200,000 Guatemalan indigenous people that reached crescendo in the 1980s. Perez Molina was a military general at the time, and he was directly involved in some of those massacres during the dictatorship of Efraín Ríos Montt. So the movement that's taken place today against Perez Molina and other government leaders for the fraud called La Línea, this customs fraud, will hopefully expand to putting him on trial for those genocidal murders that took place.
What kind of role has the U.S. played over the past couple decades in Guatemala?
The U.S. government has always been deeply involved militarily, economically, in Central America, of course, all of Latin America, but in particular with Central America. At the turn of the last century, a phenomenon called the Banana Republics formed when U.S. agribusiness corporations converted these small Central American countries into export economies for U.S. capital. Guatemala in particular, Honduras and others became what were called banana republics because the banana industry greatly expanded. In Guatemala, United Fruit Company was the largest landowner by far and yet kept over 80% of the land that it owned and controlled in Guatemala unused. So you had Guatemalan peasants starving while United Fruit made huge profits. So in the 1950s, there was a great reform movement under two presidents. In particular, one president, Jacobo Arbenz, who was elected in 1950, and he expropriated Guatemala's land that United Fruit owned, which set off a U.S. campaign for overthrow. The CIA overthrew the Arbenz government in 1954. And notorious since then has been the repression of the indigenous and working class people of Guatemala. Ever since then, over 200,000 people have been killed. In the 1980s, under the Reagan regime, Efrain Rios Montt was dictator for 2 years, 1982 to 1983. And under his dictatorship, thousands and thousands of people were killed in the most brutal attacks on indigenous villages. Over 600 villages were exterminated. And just in 2013, May 2013, Efrain Rios Montt was finally convicted for the singular crime of 1,700 Ishu Maya indigenous people who were murdered in one genocide. However, his conviction was overturned by the court, and he is still facing trial. But one of his generals, who was the recently deposed Otto Perez Molina. So now we find new national, congressional, and municipal elections that took place in Guatemala this past Sunday, September 6th. And yet the same politics continues, as the famed indigenous leader, Rigoberta Menchú, said, nothing changes with these elections. For example, the front runner, Jimmy Morales, a well-known comedian who had no political history before in Guatemala, he is representing the Frente de Convergencia Nacional, which is the most right-wing party in Guatemala, formed by ex-military generals, the same ones who carried out the genocides in the 1980s. And so this man, Jimmy Morales, is going to be engaged in a runoff with the next runner of the elections on October 25th. What will be necessary in Guatemala is a continued struggle by the masses of the hundreds of thousands who've been marching, demonstrating, not only for justice for the victims of the genocide that took place for so many years, but also for social economic justice that will require this movement that we're very excited to see developing.
We're going flag shopping for American flags. They're staring at our turbans, they're calling them rags. They're calling them towels, they're calling them diapers. They're more like crowns, let's strike them like vipers. I know why they mad, but why call us Arabs? We sad like they sad, but now we buy they flags. Spying on our Muslim brother while staring at our mother. Lover, they some bad mother. We're going flag shopping, we're going flag shopping. The kids are throwing stones and we complain but they ain't stopping. On your way to the top and now they want you to stop. Your mama pray to God but your dad'll lose his job. Your dad mad cause he lost all clients. Dad, why you crying? I thought that we had the spirit of the lion. He take it out on you, his belt big like Orion's. The NSA be spying. We're going American flag shopping, red, white, blue on our crib. The neighbors threw rocks at the house, they making it harder to live. They want a shorter version, they want a nickname. They want a Tobias like we Kunta Kinte. They want a shorter version, they want a nickname. They want a Tobias like we Kunta Kinte. Federal agents tap my mobile phone and use drones to track my mobile home. The towers hit the planes, I guess it was written. But now they all looking at us different. They looking at us different, they looking at us different. Yo, why they looking at us different? They waking up my friend at night for no reason. They promised him freedom, now he guilty for treason. The kids are leaving school, they're all misleading tools. And I was there, I saw the towers in the planes. And I'll never be the same, never ever be the same. I seen things that I never wanna see again. I heard things that I never wanna hear again. And now we're going flag shopping.
So we're here with Paige Murphy, a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and also a member of the Red Nation. We're going to talk about the organizing that they're doing for a march for Indigenous Peoples Day of Resistance and Resilience. Some of the demands for the march are abolishing a Columbus Day, evicting corporate polluters, ending border time violence, and defending treaty rights on and off native land. How you doing, Paige?
Hey, I'm doing good. Thanks.
So can you give our listeners a little bit of background if they're not aware on who the Red Nation is and what kind of work you guys do?
Sure. So, you know, the Red Nation, it initially formed in November 2014. We're almost a year old, but we formed mainly to address the marginalization and invisibility of Indigenous struggle within, you know, the mainstream social justice movement, but also to speak out and actively fight against the ongoing destruction of Native life and land. You know, Native people have been exposed to disproportionate violence, racial discrimination, the ongoing theft of land and water rights by big cities, corporations, and extraction industries, you know, which, you know, the extraction industries can vary from, you know, coal, oil, uranium, natural gas, etc. And these industries, you know, they ultimately poison our land and leave us with absolutely nothing but perverse health issues and deepening poverty, so that we're no longer able to live on our own homelands. 4 out of 5 Natives live in urban areas in refuge because our land is no longer able to sustain Native life. And, you know, Native people have survived 500 years of racialized gendered violence, which was designed to remove us from our lands and assimilate us into a system of white supremacy. So this really shows, you know, that Native people have to simply fight in order to survive. So the Red Nation, you know, we stand with all Indigenous people in the world fighting against colonialism, and we're dedicated to building a widespread movement to, you know, liberate Native people from global capitalism or imperialism.
So it might be obvious to our listeners, but why is Columbus Day so odious? And, you know, what does it represent?
Well, you know, Columbus Day, it celebrates the death and disappearance of Native people, land, and life. We call on all people to unite and declare an end to this racist colonial holiday. Native people are still here, and we're continuing an unfinished history of Indigenous resistance to this, you know, white supremacist system. This country was built on the bloodshed of 100 million Indigenous people, and, you know, that's 100 million Indigenous people. The Holocaust is widely acknowledged and is, you know, accepted as an atrocious history, which was the genocide of 7 million Jews and other oppressed people, and I don't see people celebrating Hitler Day, so why should we celebrate Columbus Day and disregard the brutal history of colonization, especially when the effects of, you know, Indigenous genocide is still so apparent? Things such as poverty, unemployment, alcohol abuse, suicide rates, homelessness, racism, mass incarceration, you know, these are all symptoms that manifested out of genocide. And, you know, we're fighting the new Columbuses, which, you know, can be described as the Peabody Coal Mine, BP, and other extraction companies that are continuing, you know, the history of land theft and water theft. The 2015 Defense Reauthorization Act authorized the illegal sale of Oak Flat, you know, which is a sacred site. It was sold to a mining company in Australia against the will of, you know, the San Carlos Apache. John McCain was recently chased out of the Navajo Nation capital, you know, who was trying to negotiate a backdoor deal to expand the Federal Reserve water rights. So to this day, you know, we're still fighting, and, you know, Native land and water is not for sale.
And in a state like New Mexico, you know, which is so heavily Native, what significance do the demands of the march have for folks living out there?
So the Native people or the native population here in New Mexico is around 200,000. That's around 10%. So there's around 10% native people living here in New Mexico, in a country that has a population of 2%. Many other states with a high population of native people do not recognize Columbus Day, including Hawaii, Alaska, South Dakota, and Oregon, and a few other cities such as Berkeley, Santa Cruz, Dane County, Minneapolis, and Seattle. So the question is, why can't we, you know, abolish Columbus Day here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, that has such a high population of Native people, and instead replace it with a day that recognizes Indigenous people's struggle and resistance to the system?
You know, we have another minute or two here. Can you speak to how widely spread issues like poverty and mass incarceration affect Native peoples?
Sure. So, you know, the poverty rate on the reservation may vary from tribe to tribe, but ultimately fluctuate anywhere from double to five times the national poverty rate. And, you know, poverty, it snowballs with mass unemployment, poor health, and just poor health care in general. Substandard housing, homelessness, low access to quality education, substance abuse, mental illness, and the list really goes on. And, you know, the statistics show that 85% of Native people are unemployed in some areas, and, you know, where there are high rates of poverty, there are high rates of crime. And Native people have the highest incarceration rate of any other ethnic group. The incarceration rate for Natives is 38% higher than the national rate. And on average, Natives receive longer sentences than non-Natives for the same crime. So, you know, this proves that the system is inherently racist and disciplines politically disenfranchised people to keep them oppressed and prevent them from challenging institutions of racism like prisons, police, and the law, which, you know, ultimately maintains the status quo. And I think it's extremely important for Natives to build bridges with other oppressed groups who are facing the same challenges. There has been a widespread movement for Black Lives Matters, but there has been silence around the Native struggle, you know, which are facing the same problems. When Native people are killed, the media and social justice movements are virtually silent. In South Dakota, Sara Lee Circle Bear, who was a pregnant Native woman, she was denied medical treatment in jail while experiencing extreme pain and crying out for help. The guards, they told her to quit faking it and to knock it off, and she later died in police custody. In Denver, Paul Castaway was a mentally ill man who was gunned down by Denver police. Once they had called in for Paul Castaway, they had told him, they specifically told the police that he had suffered from mental health issues. However, they, you know, gunned him down anyway.
So, Paige, if people are looking for more information on how to get involved in the march, how to participate, where should they go?
So you can get a hold of us from our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/theRedNation, or our Red Nation website, which is theRedNation.com. We also have a Twitter page, which is @the_red_nation.
So we're speaking with Eugene Puryear, the PSL's 2016 vice presidential candidate and an organizer with the Stop Police Terror Project in D.C. So, Eugene, you were recently in an article in the Washington City paper talking about how you were the newest and biggest thorn in the mayor of D.C.'s butt. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. You know, the article itself, the genesis of the article was a press conference that the mayor did. Currently in Washington, D.C., we're experiencing what some are calling a spike in crime, a larger number of homicides than in recent years. I believe as we speak now, we're at about 109 or 110 murders, which is on pace to be the most in, well, I don't know, let's see, 3 or 4 years for sure, certainly since 2012. And so the mayor has proposed this whole new plan that, you know, long story short, is an extension of the militarized policing mass incarceration complex. So she had a press conference that took place in a press community here in D.C., actually the community I live in. And, you know, the number of people who are active in the Black Lives Matter movement from, you know, really all over the city, but many from in the community here, other anti-violence activists who didn't agree with her plan, and just people who were generally fed up with the way it had been presented, were in attendance, and we disrupted the press conference. It, in a way, went off because she had amplified sound and powered through in some ways, but certainly we were able to interject into the conversation in a way that no one else was talking about, a whole different set of views. And so out of that, of course, there's been a lot of media attention. So yes, the City Paper article came out of that, and certainly I have to give a lot of credit to the folks who came out there with us to protest.
That's right. And can you talk exactly about what her plan is and what it details?
Exactly. So her plan is, you know, it's a sham comprehensive plan, even though it's labeled as a comprehensive plan. But essentially what it would do is it would put a lot more cops on the street. It would expand the penalties for certain crimes. And most controversially, it would be a massive expansion of police powers. It would allow the police to search the home of every single person on probation or parole 24/7 without a warrant, which they claim is going to be narrowly targeted towards quote-unquote violent criminals, although they haven't released the language, so we have no idea how it's going to be targeted. But either way, we view it as essentially being superfluous, an attempt to blame returning citizens, those who have come back from prison for this crime, and also to have a real slippery slope effect. I mean, if you think about it like this, back from prison, are not staying in one place, for instance. They're staying in many places. And so it's a way that the police can do an end run around the Fourth Amendment and use the knowledge of where someone may or may not have been living, using their presence in a home where another person perhaps is not on probation or parole but is a subject of interest as a general harassment mechanism and so on and so forth in a way that, quite frankly, really is a scary expansion of police powers and has met a lot of different proposals. Now, the mayor is also, as an add-on, talking about some things like trying to work on issues like housing and jobs and all these other things, but it really is exactly that. It's a bolt-on sort of thing to this plan that is really still firmly in the model of militarized occupation-style policing, tougher penalties, and things of that nature. That is really what the Black Lives Matter movement has been critiquing.
Well, you know, I mean, it might be obvious, but what have been some of the direct critiques made by Stop Police Terror Project and the rest of the Black Lives Matter movement?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, the thrust of what we've been saying, because interestingly enough, and I think very relevant to the impact that the Black Lives Matter movement is having around the country, the mayor keeps trying to insist that she's actually on our side and we are just intemperate activists who are just yelling and screaming and trying to get on TV, but she's trying to do the things we want. But the point we're making is that, you know, a comprehensive plan to deal with what is really the fallout from the social devastation in ghetto communities, the so-called ghetto, so-called inner city. I mean, that's what crime really is, the social fallout from this devastation that, you know, that can't really be dealt with the way we've been approaching it, which is through punitive, police-heavy, prison sentence-heavy, tougher sentence-heavy approaches. We've been doing it for 30 or 40 years, and we've shown that it hasn't really accomplished anything in terms of reducing quote-unquote crime. And further than that, it's had a tremendously destructive effect on oppressed communities here in terms of broken up families, the inability of people to get jobs when they get out, the tensions that are created from those who feel the police can bring safety, and those, especially young people who feel like the police criminalize their entire social existence, the police brutality, the harassment. I mean, all of these things that have been tremendously destructive in the community. And so what we have been saying is we need a surge of community, not of police. We need to institutionalize community-led policing to deal with their community-led security measures, I should say, to deal directly and intervene and interdict and mediate disputes to reduce the level of murders and violence. It's been shown to be effective in cities all around this country, major cities, Richmond, California, Chicago, Baltimore. Also, we're saying that, you know, we have to deal in a real way with the quote-unquote long-term issues. People need jobs, housing, mental health care, other health care, education that's good now, not later. And we have to start to not just tokenize it by saying, yes, we must deal with these things. But the mayor can't say, oh, well, yes, housing and public housing is an issue and all that kind of stuff, and then produce 1,000 units of affordable housing when the need is in the tens of thousands. Yeah. Put together a housing plan that's going to demolish public housing. I mean, it just, the two things don't go together. So we're saying deal with this directly as well. So that's our really both, it's really our critique. And quite a bit of it is what we're trying to show is that it's a counter vision. It really is a true comprehensive vision. It's in trying something completely different that's embedded in communities, that's aimed at healing, that's aimed at rebuilding communities from the ground up in terms of the most important building blocks that people need, the ability to really make a living that can support them, and to have the barriers from it removed that are keeping them from that removed.
And so, speaking of countering, what's some organizing that's been happening in addition to the event you talked about earlier, or that you guys plan on having in the coming weeks and months?
Yes, well, you know, we're here anytime between the end of September, which is when they first came out, in early October. So what we are doing in the Stop Police Terror Project DC, and anyone who's listening in D.C., we're, you know, just getting off the ground in this iteration, but they can reach us at facebook.com/StopPoliceTerrorProjectDC, easy to remember. And we're going out and we're trying to build as much opposition as possible. We've been going to town halls and community meetings and talking to people. We're going to be going out to street festivals this weekend. We're going to be knocking doors. We're making phone calls. And we're putting together a whole range of tools for people to both understand the issue. For example, a simple myth and fact sheet that breaks down some of the issues with the claims that the mayor is actually making. Also, we want to put that online as well so that people can link directly to it and use social media as a tool to educate folks. And we also want to help use not just the basic facts, but link people to more deep research that exists around these issues to help them really grasp it and be able to talk about it in an intelligent way. And so we're working on the educational front, and then we're also working to mobilize the people we're meeting and educating and talking to. There are some people, many people, especially in oppressed communities, who are intrinsically against this. There are a lot of people who are not, though, and maybe have less consciousness of what's going on, or maybe even think the police can help. And so we want to not only educate them, but then once they're educated, mobilize them to oppose this plan. We plan to continue to speak out on September 16th, the D.C. Council. We'll be holding a roundtable on this issue. We plan to be present there. So really what we are doing is trying to create a counter campaign that involves both popular education on issues of policing, mass incarceration, that pushes forward solutions as well to the issue directly of trying to reduce the rate of murders right now in the here and now, and that really speaks to how we can, in short order, start to move very quickly to deal with the social and economic pillars that have to be touched on if we really want to deal with this problem, the root of this problem, the so-called crime issue in America.
Let's keep the pressure on. We'll talk soon, Eugene.
Thank you so much.